Yeah, let's do it. Well, it's the mayor's decision.
Oh, just take it.
No, we're gonna start.
It's 9:05.
We're starting.
Okay. I am Tracy Bauer Anderson. I am the city assessor, so I oversee the assessing division that values properties for taxation purposes. So I oversee a team of 3 residential appraisers, 2 commercial appraisers, and 1 administrative staff. Tonight I'm going to give you an overview of the local board and how we value properties. And it's basically just an opportunity for you to ask questions if you have it prior to the local board, which is scheduled next Monday, April 14th. So we revalue every single property in the city annually as of January 2nd. We are governed by the state that asks us to only review sales that are considered traditional, open market, typical transactions. We're held to the standards to have our assessment be between 90 and 105% of market value. If sales indicate that market values have changed, the assessor must follow that, whether it means to increase or decrease values. The method that we use to value properties is called mass appraisal. It's different than if you were to refinance your home or purchase a home. That would be a fee appraisal. Mass appraisal means big picture valuing groups of properties using a percent, a median sale within the sales. You as a council act as the board, and you are convened to listen and address concerns of all the property owners, the taxpayers. You are going to be listening to their concerns about the values that were set as of January 2nd, 2025, which will be for taxes payable in 2026. If they should bring up questions about prior year values or taxes for 2025, that's not your jurisdiction. That's not what the meeting is about. The meeting is about the values that were set this year as of January for taxes payable in 2026. You have the authority to look at valuation and make changes to that or the classification. Again, you cannot look at prior year assessments, and you should be looking at things that are supported by fact. Each board must have a voting member that has completed the training that's put on by DOOR, the Department of Revenue. We do have 2 council members that took the course, which are Council Member Erickson and Council Member Page. And I sincerely appreciate that. Without a member having taken that training, we would have lost the ability to have had the local board. Hennepin County is present at the meeting. They will send around a form for everyone to sign at the time of the meeting, stating that you were present, you were the board. They present that to Hennepin County post the meeting. The board should take charge of the meeting. This is not my meeting. It is your meeting to review the evidence that property owners present to you, indicating that in their opinion, the value set by the assessor is incorrect. I would encourage the board chairperson to make a statement allowing each of the property owners, should they want to speak to the board, a limit on time, and I believe in the past we've used 3 minutes. I would encourage having the conversation solely be about value and classification, not taxation, because that's not what the meeting is about. And then to have the board also list to the property owners what they have the ability to do, what they cannot do. The property owners are supposed to address the board with their questions, and then the board can address the property owner or the assessor. The assessor should not be the one to directly communicate with the property owner. So you have the ability to reduce, increase, or sustain the value. You can add an improvement to the assessment role. You can change the classification, which means what is the current use of the property, residential, commercial, industrial, apartments, and you can add a property to the assessment roll. What you cannot do is consider prior year assessments. You cannot reduce the aggregate assessment by 1%. You cannot exempt a property. You cannot make changes to a property that you have a conflict of interest or a financial interest in. And you can't grant special program status. So homesteads, vets, disaster, green acres, that's solely done by the county. It's an application process. We also encourage you not to make changes to a property that a property has not allowed the assessor into the property. I encourage you to focus on value and the facts. It is assumed that the assessor has valued the properties correctly. The burden of proof is the property owners. And if you were to make a change to those values, it can impact and shift the tax burden to other people. So just make sure that when they're presenting their case, that your changes are based on fact. And if you have questions, you're welcome to ask. Decisions should meet statutory guidelines. We do allow property owners, if they would prefer us not to enter the home, or maybe their work schedule doesn't allow it, we do have a questionnaire they can fill out online, and they can also submit photos. So it's not like we're saying if we can't get in your property, we're not going to make a change. We just need to make educated guesses, too, to say, show us something that we have that should be changed by filling out the questionnaire and showing photos. This is just an overview. You each have a copy of it. Value notices went out right around the 15th of March. We have fielded about 125 calls this year. A lot of them are educational. A lot of property owners just don't understand how it's valued, what's the timeline for sales, when's the value set, when will the taxes be. Once we work through those questions, oftentimes people are relieved just to understand. Other times, we're allowed to go into a property that maybe we haven't been into for a long time, and we were able to update our records, and if a change was indicated, we were able to do that prior to the local board up until last Friday. Now we have a 10-day window between the 4th and the 14th. Any changes that we make between now or the 4th and the local board meeting, we'll have to read into the record. If we've reached an agreement and the property owners agree to it, we can make one vote. We can read all those in. We can do one vote for those. If there's properties where the property owners don't agree, we'll bring those to your attention as well. Calls are definitely different this year. We only have two that I can think of off the top of my head where we have not reached an agreement. If we don't reach an agreement, if they choose to come before the board, I would like to present to you what we have shown them. And if, by chance, we're able to resolve everything prior to the local board, and for instance, no one shows up at the local board, we would not have to have the reconvene. So I'm going to do everything possible to provide you the best information. We read those properties into the record. Those people, because we read them into the record, even if we choose not to make changes, it reserves the right for them to go on to the county. If we should need the reconvene date, it has to be within 20 calendar days. So the current reconvene date is scheduled for April 28th. We have to be careful not to adjourn the meeting. If we need the reconvene, we would recess the meeting. Once we adjourn it, we cannot make any more value or classification changes. If the property owners are not happy with what happens at the local, they can go on to the county, and this just gives you the timeline. They recommend that they make an appointment. We are the ones that go to the county as well. So sometimes prior to about 2 or 3 years ago, the county would review all these properties. They would give their opinion of value. That no longer happens. We present the case to the county board. If a property owner isn't happy between the local and the county, or for some reason they miss that, they also have the option to go to tax court. Very seldom do you see residential. We've had one case in the last year that went to tax court. Tax court is primarily for commercial, industrial, and apartments. This is just giving you an overview of the property value changes. The values that were set as of January 2nd, 2025. As you can see, as the market changes, it's not consistent between each property type. You can see that the minus almost 9% in apartment values. Apartment values increased very strongly, and they leveled out, and now they're showing a decrease. We have to follow the market. If the market tells us that the values are decreasing, our values have to reflect that. You can see that there's been a change in sales year over year between ourselves as well as surrounding cities, and that's what the grid is. The sales in the city grid is showing you. The number of sales in Brooklyn Park at 684, Maple Grove at 865, and so on. We left the prior year just to show you how it's changing universally. It's not just Brooklyn Park that's had less sales. It's overall. The pie is just showing you, if you break it down residentially, most of the sales residentially are going to be in the single family homes. This is our value growth history year over year, and we saw approximately 3.2% increase in 2025, or for the assessment set as of 2025. That is it. Jay told me to go fast, and I'll tell you what, I'm right there with you guys.
I see him over there going.
See? Go.
No, not to Tracy. Oh. That was a fire chief.
Yeah.
Yeah. And these guys in the way back are going like, get him out of here, fire chief.
That's what you get for being item number five.
Well, one of them has to be here all night, so that's why they got
it. They're going to say they would have anyway. It's no problem.
I didn't know that.
I only have one question.
Any questions?
I have one. Is that on our calendar for those dates that you put up there? I was just going to look and see.
They are on the council
calendar. Oh, it is during the meeting? Oh, it's not prior to?
We're 6 o'clock on the 14th.
Oh, okay.
And then
okay.
The regular council meeting follows.
Got it.
And the same on the 28th. We have to start at a specific time. And so we go first, and then the council meeting follows.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Any other questions?
All right, no. Thank you for making this presentation and always making it succinct to the point. I appreciate it. Then you do the same during the actual hearing. So.
Thank you.
So moving to C5, discussion of level 3 sex offenders and residency.
You guys back there, Devin, or no?
No. You just need to pull it up there.
Patiently await my invite. Let's go.
I only live there.
have us here. Definitely not in July.
Going to see more routines then.
Couldn't agree with you more.
But I feel like you got $100 earlier, so. You got $100 earlier, so I feel like you can get.
She's buying.
I am happy to buy you a birthday. I'll make you one.
You know what, she'll just pull it out of her bag right
here. Yeah, I got one right here.
You know, we have people accusing us of getting kicked out of bars, so, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just got monitored at a bar one time.
It's fine, this isn't a bar.
Yeah, you're right.
That's true.
So, thank you.
Thanks for waiting.
I appreciate it.
All right, Mayor Winston, council members, myself and Inspector Matt Raby are going to share some information, answering questions you have tonight in regards to the possibility of adding an additional city ordinance for level 3 predatory offenders. Inspector Raby kind of became aware of this issue a month or so ago after a phone call that he's going to share with you. What we're asking for you tonight after the presentation is just to give us some direction if we should proceed with drafting a possible ordinance or if we shouldn't. And City Attorney Jim Thompson is on virtually. He also weighed in and gave us some information as well, so this is part of it. I'll turn it over to Inspector Raby since he did all the research.
Mayor Winston, members of the council, thank you for having me tonight. I am Matt Raby. I am the Dorton Precinct Inspector. I want to allay your fears. It's a very, very short slide deck, and I'm not asking for any funds tonight, so that should make it a little bit easier for everybody.
Take all the time you need.
How much bonding?
That comes later.
So first, we're going to go real quick. What is predatory offender? Predatory offender is anybody in Minnesota that has been charged and convicted of any of these crimes or charged with these crimes and then convicted of a lesser crime. There are a whole host of qualifying crimes, but you'll notice that really they are usually sexual in nature, criminal sexual conduct, prostitution, soliciting minor, things like that. That is our definition of predatory offender. When someone is convicted of one of these crimes and goes to prison in Minnesota, when they're released, there is a group that reviews that case, that specific incident, reviews their prior history. I probably should talk into the microphone. Sorry, Jim, you're still here. Review prior history. They review, like, were they responding to treatment. They review a whole host of things. That law enforcement, that's social workers, caseworkers, a group of people that are on this review board. And then they assign them a risk level. There are actually four. A lot of people think of it as three, but there are a group of unassigned. That group of unassigned is essentially, there's a list of reasons why they might not be assigned. There is a very large group of unassigned predatory offenders in the state of Minnesota. But the three list risk levels that they do assign are 1, 2, and 3. 1 is the lowest, and these are risks of reoffense, is essentially what they're assessing. Risk level 3 is the highest risk of reoffense. So who gets notified in these certain circumstances? The Brooklyn Park Police Department, in every local jurisdiction, the police department is required to check in on these predatory offenders annually. We do that work. So we know when there is all of these predatory offenders in our city, but we can't necessarily notify everybody. They're not always public. The unassigned, we find out about them. Level 1, the victims, witnesses, and then, of course, us. Level 2 is victims, witnesses, us. And then individuals that may be at risk. For instance, if someone who is level 2 lives at a home where there maybe are other vulnerable individuals, then that might be appropriate for us to notify those individuals or the manager of that home because they may be at higher risk. And then level 3, of course, the highest level, is a public notification. Essentially what happened was I was promoted to precinct inspector. I kept noticing these notifications come up because I get them. And I was like, boy, we've had a lot recently. And then I found out that one of them recently came because he was living in Brooklyn Center. Brooklyn Center said, hey, you can't live there. We have an ordinance against you living here. You got to get out. And then they called looking around and said, you guys have an ordinance? And we were like, no. Oh. And then they moved into Brooklyn Park. When I started looking into our predatory offenders, we have 220, and this is a moving target. It's literally changing by the day. Right now, in total, that's unassigned all the way through level three, we have 220 to 230 predatory offenders in the city of Brooklyn Park, living in Brooklyn Park. This is the Choropleth map that I made. This was kind of manual work. I had to go through the public information database to figure out all of the cities in Hendrick County and where these level three sex offenders were living. The reason I made a Choropleth map is because, to be honest with you, I thought it looked a lot like the congregate care facilities Choropleth map that I've been looking at. Obviously, the outlier is Minneapolis, has a very large number, 121. Maybe not that large for how large of a city they are. But Brooklyn Center, you'll notice, is a bit of an outlier, a little bit different than the congregate living Choropleth map we've been looking at. I believe, personally, that is because they have an ordinance, and they clearly enforce that ordinance by telling people, you got to get out. Golden Valley, you'll notice, actually has a relatively high number, quite a high number for the size of their city. I look again today, it's gone from 7 to 8. This data is publicly available on the Minnesota state website. So when I looked at how many cities have an ordinance, I looked at every single city in Hennepin County. 18 cities have an ordinance restricting residency of predatory offenders. Level three predatory offenders. 27 do not. And let's see. I want to point out Golden Valley does not have one. Also, interestingly enough, Bloomington doesn't have one. They've only got one or two level threes. This may have changed. Yeah, I think they have one I looked at today. Like I said, this changes about daily. We have been, since I've been looking, at between 19 and 21 consistently. We clearly have an inordinately high number compared to all of the cities surrounding us. So what is in some of these residency restrictions? First of all, I would point out that they really are focused on level three predatory offenders. They're not focused on the unassigned through two. They're really focused on those that are at the highest risk of reoffense, or at least deemed to be by the state. And essentially what they're doing is they're placing a restriction on where they can have temporary or permanent residency, and they're doing it by feet. They're essentially saying you can't live this many feet from a school, a place of worship, a child care center, a park, you know, places where children are known to gather and congregate. And the distance seems to vary. I've read a whole bunch of these ordinances, and they're 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet, 2,000 feet. So it's kind of all over the map as far as the distance, but that's generally what they're focused on, is saying you cannot live from this point to this point. Usually the way they're measuring distance is the edge of the property that they're living at to the edge of the property that they're barred from. This is a type of work that we've done in the past with our GIS coordinator, John Derby, and it is pretty easy for him to figure out essentially what percentage of our housing stock would be allowable for predatory offenders to live in if we enacted an ordinance like this, based on the distance, 800 feet, 1,000 feet, 300 feet, 2,000 feet, we'd be able to see what percentage. A lot of the ordinances I've seen have exceptions. And typically those exceptions are allowing people that are already living there, which makes sense if you're a level three predatory offender and then you're enacting this law, it allows people that are already living there. And then like if you were a minor offender when you committed the offense, things like that. The other one is if the DOC decides to have a prison in the city, there's usually exceptions for that. And then the last slide I have here, and Jim Thompson, I saw him log in just a minute ago, can chime in, was some potential court challenges or legal concerns. There have been some, there's been a lawsuit in Minnesota for one of these ordinances, and there's been some challenges to this. and I'll let Jim speak more about that. Also, Jim did find this Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers study. Really, I shouldn't have written study in there. It's not a study. It's just a review of literature that synthesizes all of the information and puts it into a, like a two-page document. It sounds like this organization advocates for predatory offenders, and as you can imagine, there's probably not a lot of groups that do that, so there's not a lot of really good information, up-to-date information on that. Jim, are you on? Is there any weighing in you'd like to do on any legal concerns?
Yes, sir.
Breaking up.
You sound like you're in an echo chamber, Jim.
Yeah, hang on.
I think we lost it.
You there, Jim?
I thought you said to hang on.
Oh, okay. You can hang on a little bit. You guys have any questions for me in the meantime?
Yes.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I'll just say that really quickly. I just want to know how, what the maximum distance we can put, because if we've got this disproportionate amount, what's the maximum? But then there's probably some reasonableness constraint within the law. So that's what I would want kind of Jim to speak to, but I kind of think we need to put a ordinance. We need to have some type of ordinance in place. This is also part of the state kind of looks at Brooklyn Park as a default for all of these different issues. And so where we can address it, we should be inclined to address it. Councilmember Klonowski.
Thanks, Mayor. Question. Sex workers don't fall under level 3 unless it involves a minor.
It's someone that is convicted of one of those crimes, and someone that then, after they're released from prison, they do this assessment and decide they're level 3. I would call it very unlikely.
Okay, because I thought it said like prostitution with a minor involved or something. So a regular sex worker not involved with minors, it's not necessarily going to fall under a level 3 predator.
I would be surprised.
Okay.
But I don't know every single person that's got
yeah.
it. I'd be surprised.
Okay, fair enough.
That usually is applying to someone who's convicted of prostitution with a minor, not the actual sex worker.
Got it. Okay. That was a point of clarification I was seeking. And then if we have 20 people currently here and we didn't put an ordinance that said, say, you have 5 years to find another place to live if it's within this distance, according, you know, of course, we have to hear from Attorney Thompson, but why would they leave? So then our number might never go below 20 or 15.
I think that's a very reasonable question. And there is one thing I should probably add in that I forgot to mention earlier. 50% of our level 3 sex offenders are in congregate care facilities right now in Brooklyn Park. I do personally think there's a tie between that. I think, you know, when they're being released from prison, they're being sent to some of these congregate care facilities.
Yep.
But letting Jim in here. Yeah, that's a really good question. I think the real question is, if all of the other cities have this ordinance, would they be able to leave?
Yeah.
Or if we're the last one to enact it, it's too late.
Right.
And I'll just add, it's kind of a weird dynamic, but population of level 3 sex offenders, for the most part, is very, not very transient, but it is transient, and they do move around. The list that I looked at today from doing this over the past 10 years, I recognize one name.
Okay. So if we did have an ordinance, it could bring the number down over, maybe over a little more years than we would be comfortable, but it could potentially.
I believe so.
Okay. Thank you. Excuse me.
Wait,
am I back in?
And then,
yes.
Jim, we can hear you. Did Mr. Mayor, did you want to...
Oh, yeah, I had a, before Councilman Harrison, I had a question in terms of, I mean, in terms of how far, because it's saying 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet, can we do 2,000 and 3,000 feet? What's like, there's probably got to be, there's probably some reasonableness constraints there. So what are some of the constraints and challenges to us if we put some type of ordinance in place like this?
Mr. Mayor, maybe I can help with that one.
Yeah. Yep. That was. That
yes,
was
please
it.
Do.
That was it, you.
Okay, so you can hear me. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, so there's been two legal types of challenges to these types of ordinances, even though there's probably over 100 cities now that have them. One was back in 2018, the city of Dayton, who adopted one. They just were the unfortunate city that got sued by three offenders who wanted to move into the city and were prevented by the resident restrictions from doing that. They sued the district court. This is in state court. The district court held that the city's ordinance was invalid in its entirety, and the reason for that was the judge concluded that state law preempted cities from regulating in this area. Preemption means there are certain topics on which cities cannot regulate because they've been superseded by state law. The building code is a primary example of that. Cities cannot regulate in areas that the building code regulates because it's preempted by state law. And this particular judge relied on that legal theory to say the state law on this issue preempted or stopped cities from regulating in it in entirety. Okay. Now that was a trial court decision. It wasn't appealed, and trial court decisions are not binding other than the city in this case that was involved. There was a second type of lawsuit, which was in federal court. This particular one was involving the city of Apple Valley. In that lawsuit, the court concluded that the resident restriction was a violation of the offender's constitutional rights to live in communities. The facts of that case were not good for the city because the way they adopted the ordinance, it didn't really allow almost any place in the city for the offenders to reside. And I can't recall at the moment whether that restriction only applied to level 3 offenders or maybe applied to more. So in that case, the city settled. They ended up paying $70,000 in damages and attorney's fees in the case. And since it was settled, it never been appealed. So there are court decisions out there that have not gone city's way in this issue. Having said that, there, as you just heard, there's a lot of cities that have them, including Brooklyn Center. So there is a risk to the city of adopting one. In this case, if you were to want to move forward with this issue, we would want to make sure that whatever restriction was placed on them allowed some reasonable area in the city for these offenders to reside. So that's kind of the legal side of things. The study that was referred to, I agree, it was probably not a neutral study. But the gist of that study was that most overwhelming enough of sexual predators, their victims are somehow related or connected to the offender. They're a stepchild, they're a family member of some sort. It's not related to proximity to minors, okay? That's now... The legitimacy of that study I can't comment on, but that's the theory behind it. I've been recently involved in this issue with another city, and the sexual predator offender there the victim in that his, in that case was actually not a relative. It was a third person, not related in any way to the offender. So it's not universally true that the victims are somehow connected with the offender. So again, though that type of evidence comes in and sort of one sort of case. And then one thing I actually didn't know of and just thought about when the presentation was being made, if the city were to adopt something, you can see that the question is whether there's a relationship between residency restrictions and the number of sexual offenders that happen to reside in the city. Bloomington was the example I was thinking about when I was listening to the presentation that does not have one of these types of ordinances, but apparently does not have many of these sexual offenders. So that might relate a lot, might relate to, you know, the ability of these residents to, I don't know, the type of income, the type of households, it could have a different relationship than just the whether or not the city has a residential regulation in place. So that's not technically a legal issue, but I thought about it when I heard the presentation. So anyway, that's just additional information. I can't say, I would not advise the council that you cannot adopt one of these. Obviously, there's a lot of cities that have. Is there a potential risk to it? Yes, but that's just a decision for the council to weigh in deciding whether or not to adopt one. My recommendation would be if the council would decide to move forward with additional information on this and studies, or not studies, but information, that we make sure that whatever restrictions adopted would not absolutely preclude a potential offender from living in the city.
Thank you. Councilor Erickson.
Just a couple of fairly quick questions. Do the level 3 sex offenders appear on our heat map anywhere?
You mean our heat map of crimes?
Yeah.
I haven't overlaid the two. I do know where the level 3 sex offenders live, and they're spread out pretty sporadically throughout the entire city. They're not just, our heat map is the Zane corridor.
Sure. Right?
They don't all live in the Zane corridor.
But like they're not searchable per se to residents. Like I couldn't look up and see where they live in Brooklyn Park.
Actually, you can. You can see what block they live in. It's on the state website.
It's on the state website.
Yep. Okay. And it will say what block they live in. It'll also say what type of crime they committed. Like, if they coerced a child or whatever the case is.
Point to that though, Minnesota does not give geography information. You go to other states, you can pull up a city and see everybody there. So you will have to go. It'll give you the list of the 19 that are currently residing in Brooklyn Park, and you have to go individually to see where they are.
When you're notified of one of these folks arriving in Brooklyn Park, do we have a notification mechanism for people besides residents? I mean, my day job, I work with a lot of church leaders, and it's a common struggle. One of these folks shows up in your congregation on Sunday morning. but do we notify, or could we notify community organizations about their presence?
It's a good question. We don't specifically focus on organizations. We do focus on the area and send out flyers.
Yeah.
Essentially, it's got information on who the person is. It includes a picture of them, the type of crime that they were convicted of, essentially kind of what happened. And then sometimes community members in that area will ask for a community meeting where we'll show up, we'll talk about it. We don't specifically send out all to organizations throughout the city, but that is something that we could consider.
And those notification meetings are done by the state. They send a person out to run the meeting and share their information.
If it'd be possible to build that into the ordinance, I think it would be valuable to build a list of organizations that are vulnerable to the situation and maybe notify if it's legal to do so. And then Lastly, I would really love to see, before we make any further decisions, like, if Mr. Nurgi can put together a map of like 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet, 2,000 feet, and then like schools and parks, schools, churches, and parks, just so we can visualize what that means, what those different mixes and scenarios mean for us.
Yeah, I've actually just spoken with John Nurgi about this exact topic and asked that exact question. No problem. My recommendation would be that we come back with a series of maps. This is what it looks at 500 feet, 800 feet, 1,000 feet, 1,500 feet, 2,000 feet, and what percentage of our housing stock would allow for a level 3 predatory offender to live there at each distance.
Thank you. That was all right.
Councilmember Tran.
My question is, are the same offender include the pedophile?
I'm sorry, say that one more time.
Include the pedophile.
Pedophile?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you're convicted of pedophilia or having sex with a minor, yes, it would include that. Now, that's assuming they're released from prison and then the assessment team decides that they're at a high level of reoffense.
And how long they be supervised?
Yeah, that's a good question. So typically, people will stay on this for as long as they're required to register, so they have to register. Registration generally required for a period as short as 10 years to as long as lifetime, based on a number of factors. I would say a level 3 sex offender is most likely going to be registering for life.
So probably the officer or somebody who supervises them we'll meet them every semester or every month?
No, the state isn't. Well, it depends on the conditions of their release. They may be on probation or parole, or maybe on supervised release for a certain given number of months or what have you. However, we, the local jurisdiction, are required to check on all of our predatory offenders once a year. So one of our police officers will go out, knock on the door, say, hey, Mr. Whatever, is all of your information current? We will snap a picture of them and then we will submit that to the state.
So, do you let them know before you arrive? Because sometimes they are not home, they working somewhere?
No, and sometimes we find that they're not there anymore, or sometimes we find that they're not home and we check back on them later. The address is sometimes old, sometimes they're offending because they haven't updated their registration.
So they require to let the authority know wherever they've been.
Yes.
So that does mean they violated.
Yeah, so if they move, let's say someone moves from Brooklyn Park to Maple Grove, they have to let Maple Grove know right away that they have moved to Maple Grove.
So, you know, do you do that to make sure that, you know, other where they've been to, they aware of them?
If they leave and go to another city,
yeah.
Well, we don't typically know that until we do our once a year check. But and then we find out, oh, hey, this person is not up to date. We don't know where they're at. We report it to the state, and then they can be considered in violation.
They locate him by the ID, driver license?
There's no easy way to locate a person.
Oh, my. So that's mean scary.
There are a number of predatory offenders that have unknown addresses. In fact, many of them are listed in this database, the state database, and they make clear that their address is unknown. They're in state, or they believe they're in Hennepin County, but they don't know their address, not their address.
So how can we protect the public that way?
They get a warrant issued for them for being non-compliant to the sex offender. It's a crime. So if they haven't re-registered and they move, it becomes a crime and a warrant is issued. But you can also be a level 3 predatory offender and not have a permanent address and maybe live in a shelter in Minneapolis, and then they check in with their probation or parole officer and do things that way if they don't have an actual physical permanent address.
So do we have like a program to help those people, like, you know, community, you know, because sometimes we want them to have a good relationship with people so that they might, you know, become better. They can find job, they can find house. Otherwise, we have to provide them shelter, right? If they don't have job. And so we do the authority or society have that kind of program, or we, like local government, have to provide them that?
That type of program would probably be considered outside of the scope of the city, providing housing and jobs specifically for predatory offenders.
Yeah, and
so just quickly, is this driving towards this particular resolution, or are we just trying to figure out how the program works for level 3 sex offenders across the state? So are you trying to do that research, or are we trying to drive towards whether we want an ordinance or not?
Local government.
So you just want to know all about level 3 sex offenders at the local level?
Yeah.
I don't know that we can cover that in this particular meeting.
But if they live in our city, you know, and if we can, by the way, give them a like supervise, but at the same time you can condone, like can help them to, you know, go to church or with the community, they might, you know, get better. They might.
Could I comment on that by chance?
Please do.
So if you go to, okay, there's a liability there, so I don't think any of us have the degree or the education to do that. So, but I want to tell you, if you go to the website, you can see all of the information about what their offense was, if they completed their sentence, and who they're responsible to reporting to. And so maybe you could personally look at that. I don't think that's a state thing. I don't think that's a city thing, and I may be wrong on that. But I've been going through all of them because they're all the ones that are registered. I know there's a whole bunch that aren't. But it does give you all those facts if they've completed their required sentence. Is that right? Would that be the right word?
I know that program.
Yeah.
And then there's a website that you can type in, and they let you know that, who live in that area.
Yep. And it also gives, like, the supervising agent, the supervising comments, when they were released, and then it gives the offense statutes and everything that they're doing and anything that they've reported. So and there's a whole other section for you if you have searches and questions about that person. You can go to all of that and see what that is. It looks like that's what the state, the Department of Corrections has for that.
You know, I mean different. I mean, like, the law don't allow us to get them out of the city. We can make the ordinance to limit them to be close to the school to protect the public, the children.
Yeah.
But you have to give them a place to live. It's human rights. So that's why I think if, you know, we know where they live, we may make a program like the community, like, oh, what do you need, tell you, but at the same time we can watch them close.
Can we have a discussion about this? Because I would argue my responsibility is for the law-abiding citizens of this city and their safety.
Yeah.
That's my responsibility. I'm sorry, they're not my responsibility.
No, I don't believe so. Because
I would like to keep this on track. I would say that we're talking about level 3 sex offenders, and by definition, I think that has been left out. By definition, in law, those are determined to be people who are going to most likely, who are the highest risk to re-offend. And I do think that there's a responsibility generally to residents to say, how do we maintain they have a certain level of safety at the state level and the county level? This is not a... So the way the government is kind of organized, this is more, if you're trying to rehabilitate, that is more of a county level thing. They have the resources and the budget to do that where other cities do not. I would say if that's your concern, petition the county. I don't think you're going to find a lot of people that are going to support you on it, but I think there's going to be... You should petition the county for level 3 sex offenders, the pedophilia, the rapists, all the people that we're talking about. Petition Hennepin County to say maybe there's some programs that can reoffend the people that are most likely, I mean, that can rehabilitate the people that are most likely to reoffend. We gave notice to our residents. We did not give notice to our residents that we were going to talk about rehabilitating sex offenders. What we did give notice to that was going to occur in this work session that is open to the public that our residents have prepared for if they wanted to show up. But we did give notices. We're going to talk about level three offenders and their particular residency within the city of Brooklyn Park, and that they are overrepresented within our city. And what has been put before us has been, do we want to continue, do we want to consider a certain ordinance that will help protect overall residents, but also help Brooklyn Park not be the default for sex offenders? Because we should not be the default for all of the things that the state struggles with, right? So I think we should reset and focus on, before we have to start making motions and going in a certain direction to narrow this down, I would say simply focus on at hand, do we wish to have an ordinance? If we wish to have an ordinance, what does that ordinance look like? And I will say this, in general, what I've heard is folks are generally in favor of an ordinance. We want to make sure that it is reasonable enough that we don't keep people from entirely moving to the city because it seems to be challengeable in court. And so we want to make sure that it's reasonable enough that people are not inclined to move to Brooklyn Park, and that people are not sending level three sex offenders to Brooklyn Park. So that's where I think things generally stand.
I agree with you, Mr. Mayor. You know, we protect the public, but also those people, sex offender.
I'm not excited about them.
They also human. They also have their human
rights.
Point
of order. That's not on the agenda tonight.
That's not on the agenda. We're not legislating whether they're human beings or not. In some regards, there's people that when you cross certain lines,
but you cannot deny their human rights.
We can take a vote. We can take a vote to limit speech. We can limit it to a minute or two per councilor. Now, if you'd like us to do that, Councilor Tran, because you want
to
argue.
Yeah, you continue to abuse the powers. You know.
You can.
This is my time to speak. Ask question. Why did you jump in and cut me off?
Because you're not focusing on, and I'm tasked with facilitating. And I think you have a general, not even a general. I think you have a legitimate misunderstanding of how this works and who is elected to what position.
So
let me finish, because my job is to facilitate.
No, this is my time to ask questions to the officer.
Councilmember Tran, my job is to facilitate. And I think
you jump in and you cut me off. That's not
facilitating. That's part of facilitating, because you were going in a direction
you
that is not honoring
another direction.
Respectfully, I don't mean to interrupt, but you cut me off, Councilmember Tran.
No, so this is my time to speak. You guys jump in and cut me off.
So
we take
don't
a recess.
Raise your voice. This is a calming moment right now. You respectfully, you interrupted me when I asked if we could have a discussion, and you said yes.
You guys jump in and cut me off. I was asking questions to the officer.
It's process and procedure. We're not following right now. So he's in charge. We report to our mayor. Our mayor is in charge of this conversation.
The mayor facilitated. The mayor.
You may want to look up what that word facilitate means before we have to go into a brief recess. Because it seems like you can't control how you're responding to this. Now, I can't put it up for a vote. I can say, hey, let's make a motion. Can we limit people's motion to limit people to 2 minutes?
Again,
per state.
Abuse of power.
Second. Is there a second?
Bully.
Okay. Seconded by Councilmember Klonowski. All those in favor say aye.
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 Nay.
Any nays? Nay. Great. So we're going to limit it to 2 minutes. If you'd like to finish, you've got 2 minutes, then we're going to move to the next people. I'll put the timer on. We'll go from there. I get it. We'll be in Facebook tomorrow. But we at least want to be able to run the meeting.
So the thing I want to say is that, you know, those prisoners, they also human. So, you know, besides protecting the public, we also, that's why the law don't allow us to get them out of the city. Like, we can limit them, you know, near to the school or near to the children or, you know, near to the church or near to the, you know, nursing home or what, but you cannot, you know, deny them the right to find a shelter, a place to live, right?
So I think please order. That's not a question, it's a statement.
Well, it's okay. We'll just let her.
Oh my gosh.
Okay.
We'll let her finish.
It's not a question.
You mind your own business.
Well, hold on, Councilmember Page. We'll let her. But you have.
You violate my right.
Councilmember Tran, we have. You have a minute 27.
Mayor Winston, council members, council member Tran, that is not a duty imposed upon the local jurisdiction or us. That is run by the state or the county. They do have programs. Our job that gets pushed down to us from the state is simply yearly compliant checks on all the individuals, meaning we go to their house, we see that they live there where they registered, and if make sure they're compliant, that they're living there, following their stuff. That's all we do. It takes us usually a minute if they're home. If not, we come back several times to make sure or do a follow-up investigation. If they're not there, we can prove that they live there, we have reason to believe they don't, then we submit a case to the county attorney for a non-compliant predatory offender. But that is our job, and that's the only duty imposed upon the local jurisdiction.
Yeah, I know your job is kind of like an officer, so, but I just, you know, suggest that we are legislator, maybe, you know, in the time frame, the limitation of a local, you know, government, we can do something more like, because the thing you just say that sometimes they move and we don't know where they are, so maybe in the future we make more like program for them to, I mean, we watch them closer, but at the same time we, you know, give them a chance to be better, you know, community hand, you know, helping religious organization, you know.
So
just suggest
if
to
you
my
could answer,
college.
Because we're past
yeah.
2 minutes,
yeah.
If you could answer, and then we'll go to
Mayor Winston, Councilman Tran, I don't disagree with you. I would say that rehabilitating predatory offenders is typically outside of the scope of the local jurisdiction, the municipality, and the local police department, and not something that we have a program currently developed to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilman Klanowski.
Thank you, Mayor. First of all, the fact that people that are at a high risk of reoffending are out in the community is a problem, but not ours, so not a local level to solve. But I did have a question. We have discussed, and I think there are some ordinances currently in place in the city of Brooklyn Park that limit certain behavior from 1,500 feet of a park or school. What are those? Like smoking? What are the other? There's something to do with cannabis use.
Selling, yeah.
Yeah, what else are we limiting?
It's around drug sales.
Okay.
And I'm not...
It's drug sales, liquor store, liquor, tobacco licenses.
And are those
yeah.
typically 1,500?
Yeah, good question. So I was thinking criminal because
yeah,
the police.
That's
but
what you do.
Yeah, drug sales, specifically like someone illegal drug sales, there's limitations. But as far as licensing is concerned, yeah, there's around alcohol, tobacco, and now THC. Which
mm-hmm.
is why John Dirty has recently been working on putting some of these maps together.
Okay. So now some people get all up in arms about THC being anywhere, and we got to keep it, you know, 50,000 feet away from kids, which also I do agree, we shouldn't have drugs from kids. But then that makes such a strong case to put in an ordinance that says 1,500 feet, 2,000 feet from these places where children are. But then when I think about this, and there's a conversation about a map, there should be some ordinance. We have way too many level 3 sex offenders currently here. I'm a huge supporter of this, about 1,500 feet or more. But what about apartment buildings? I mean, just in the nature of apartment buildings, you're going to have so many children. How do we, if we can get the number down, I think that helps in the grand scheme of things, but how do we protect children that are living in these apartment buildings? Kind of what Councilmember Harrison was saying, the notification going to churches, daycare centers, all the places, Zanewood, where we have kids going, so that, you know, a predator can't come in and volunteer. How do we protect kids throughout the city? And it's not just kids, right? I assume there's like high-level rapists that are also attacking people and...
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really fair question. I think one of the things to address is whether or not we want to enact some sort of ordinance that focuses on that, right? A potentially wider notification system is something that we could take a look at. And then also what we as police department are already doing, like I mentioned, is going out every single year and checking on these predatory offenders. So, you know, the list was developed for law enforcement. I mean, at the end of the day, so if we have someone reoffend, essentially we have a list of people in the area that are potential suspects. We're a little bit more proactive about going out and talking to them and checking on them and making sure we know where they are. But those, I think, are the components that go into trying to protect the public.
I'm a big fan of both of these things, an increased notification system and the distance to, you know, where children are more vulnerable. Thank you, Mayor.
Councilmember Joe.
Thank you, Mayor. Just a quick clarification question. You mentioned earlier the lawsuit against one of the ordinances. Is it just the one that Attorney Thompson had mentioned in Dayton and Apple Valley, or is there another one as well?
I'm not sure if Jim is still on, but those are the two that we located, were those two specifically. As he mentioned, they weren't binding. And like he said, there is some risk that's associated with this. I also do think it's fair to point out that Bloomington doesn't have an ordinance, and they only have one level 3 sex offender. The question why, my belief is a lot of it is associated with congregate care facilities.
Okay. And really quick, too, about the mask. I'm like talking faster now. I know that timer's off. Okay, so with the maps, are you guys going based off of Plymouth's ordinance, like parks, schools, childcare, churches, everything, or are we going based upon our own standard of what's likely to be adopted into ordinance? Or
council gets to choose, and it is completely up to you guys, and I can show you what you want. You want all of those things, you want some of those things, you want to add something else in, we can look at all of those things, bring back a map, and then also consult with council to ensure that it's something that we believe will pass muster.
All right, then may I add, I got a quick glimpse at Plymouth's earlier. I like that one, I mean, just to start off with the maps. And then also then thinking realistically of the amount of parks we have here in Brooklyn Park, if it comes to like a drastic, you know, limitation where we barely have any space, you know, I would say then we could start reducing it because I don't want to get sued too, like Apple Valley.
I don't know if someone else is
there. I'm after you. I can go after you.
Councilmember,
just a really quick question about the lawsuit. I think it's worth getting sued over, challenge it. Mm-hmm. And and we have attorneys on retainer. I think our duty is to do the most we can to protect children. Mm-hmm. And if that means going to the courts and being challenged,
yeah,
bring it on.
Oh, I like that.
That's my attitude about it.
I'm going to speak on that after. But Councilman Page.
I would just add that, so I think there's definitely a consensus that there's an agreement that we want more information on that. So whoever is, if that's Jim or whoever, I think we should also include future discussions on the congregate care and what we can do about that separately, but in this ordinance to have more information on including vulnerable adults, which is what we're also going to find in those congregate care homes. So whatever information you bring to, first of all, thank you for doing it. You saw a problem and you brought it to us, and it's a clear problem. I also support what you said about transient, because it does show there's only one since 2017, and then the rest are all like 24, 25, 22. So it's been recent, which is also the increase of the congregate. So it's just all adding up, right? So if we could just have more information on what that ordinance would look like, I would like to hear about parks, schools, all of that. 1,500 feet is not, it will not eliminate living spaces in Brooklyn Park, I don't think, if that's, whatever that amount is. If you go 1,500 feet, I think I'd like to see all that information when we get together again on voting for an ordinance. I'm trying to choose my words carefully, if that makes sense.
Okay, so just to kind of wrap it up, I do think that...
Jim Thompson.
Oh, good.
And then I know you had one more quick question. Attorney Thompson?
Yes, just two things. I wanted to follow up on Councilmember Erica's point. The notification requirement is set by state law, and it graduates up from obviously level one, and then there's a state law that says this is who you should notify or you may notify, and as it goes up to level two, it says you must notify everybody you would notify on level one, and so there are notification requirements in state law those apply to all cities, regardless of whether they have a residency issue or requirement or not. Just wanted to point that out, that that's a separate issue than the residency requirement. And briefly to answer one question that came up is, I've been aware of another, of a lawsuit in Wisconsin on challenges to this. I haven't tracked down that court decision, but there's apparently one in Wisconsin, or involving Wisconsin City, that apparently set aside some city ordinance, but I don't know enough about that to give an opinion on. So I do think there's room here to adopt a regulation that hopefully would pass muster. We just need to look at more details on that.
Some American. Thank you. Jim, do you know if the notification requirements is a minimum or a maximum?
Yes.
Could a municipality go beyond that?
Good question. What the statute says is there's both a must and a may. So in some situations it says a city must notify, and others it says it may notifies. And it focuses on the two phrases in the statute are individuals that the offender is, quote, likely to encounter, who may fit the profile of what the offender's victim was. And then the second phrase is individuals who are likely to be victimized by the type of individual that the offender was involved with. Likely to encounter deals with spatial thing, location. Likely to be victimized deals with the, so a victim could be someone who wouldn't live anywhere near where this offender would reside. It's not a spatial thing. Likely to encounter usually includes someone who lives nearby. So I don't have the statute right in front of me, but there is some must and there is some may in the statute, and I can certainly follow up to make sure you get all that information.
Thank you.
All right, so City Manager Schroeder, I know you had.
Yeah, just really quick. I understand that we're talking about distance requirements from parks, schools, so on and so forth. Is there any, there may be no reason for this, but are there any ordinances where there's distance requirements between sex offenders themselves?
Actually, I did see one in the many that I was reading through.
Yeah.
And I could look into that a little bit deeper and bring it back as a potential option. I think we would probably have to exempt those that are currently here, would be my guess. And they are spread out through the city pretty well. But I know that there is an ordinance that has it, because I saw it.
Do y'all feel like it's justified? Like, is there any, from a law enforcement perspective?
That's a really good question. One of the things that I think we're going to see, and I hate to jump ahead, but I think what we're going to see is we're going to see a map that's going to show the percentage of housing stock that would allow a level 3 sex offender to live there if we enacted an ordinance at 800 or 1,000 or 1,500 or whatever. And then essentially you're looking at pockets, right? So then if you also enact an ordinance that says you can't be such a distance from another level 3 sex offender, well, this level 3 sex offender has that pocket tied up.
Right.
Right? And then this sex offender has that pocket tied up. That's what I predict the map would look like and what the impact of having that specific part of the ordinance would be, I think, very limiting.
Yeah. Or you could end up, where there's a pocket where there's like 10 living all within a small geographic area, too.
Yes.
Which even puts that geographic area at greater risk.
Yep.
Yeah, so I think, just to summarize, I think by the nature of them being level 3 sex offender, we didn't say level 1, right? There's some meaning to that legal language in terms of those are the folks that are most likely to reoffend. So I think looking at that full suite of options, whether it's 1,500 feet, schools, you know, churches, parks, etc., and then in terms of what the, you know, City Manager Strobel was talking about in terms of
not having folks too close together. I think that's going to be incredibly important. But I would suggest this, rather than having that brought to us at a regular council meeting, I hate to push it out, but I think we should have it at a work session.
Okay.
I think we should have a work session because I think the vast majority of residents are going to be focused on the approach that the vast majority of the council has advocated for here. I do not want a situation where people think that the council is saying, well, this is lightweight stuff, right? So I think we need to have it in a work session, and then from that work session, then once we've tightened it up a bit, then we can bring it to the council meeting and have it kind of much more fully baked in terms of the concepts that we want to deal with or what we're looking at. And I'll just say, for my two cents, as far as the legal challenge, I'm with, that was the first thing I heard when I said legal challenge. I said, well, if there's two trials that happen, this is something that Brooklyn Park is willing to take on. And I also think that it's also, it would be, if people wanted to go there with us, it's an opportunity for us to say as a city, like, hey, look, we're not the default when it comes to the stuff that you don't want to deal with, whether it's concrete care facilities, which seem to, there's a lot of NIMBYism across the state against it, where they're saying concentrate in these two cities. I think we're the opposite of NIMBY when it comes to that stuff, right? But many affordable housing, many of the issues that we've taken on, I think we need to send a strong message that we are not the default, that this is a statewide issue. It's not a Brooklyn Park, Brooklyn Center, or Northwest Suburbs issue, right? This is something for everyone across the state. They have to grapple with this stuff as well. And we're going to help people get to the right decision on that. So I think we're taking the right approach. I just think it's how we finish this thing. It needs to be another work session on it. That gives you the time. And then from there, I think we can, then we can have the final ordinance created from there. But thank you for your work on this.
Thanks.
I know this is a difficult subject. I don't think that the council is saying we want to further punish people who have served their time. I don't think that's it at all. My wife, I have two daughters, I have a son. And I think people just want to feel like there's some level of safety when someone has literally, by legal definition, been categorized as someone who is more likely to re-offend, right? So I think that's the key language that maybe some folks are missing here. So I think that's that. I hope you guys got what you needed from us on that piece. And then thank you for bringing this to us. I know that y'all deal with this on a regular basis, so thank you for what you do, and thank you for bringing it to us in this matter as well.
Thanks very much, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Next, we'll go to council member reports and announcements.
I have a really simple one. I just wanted to say, the newer members, you guys ask really good questions, and I constantly appreciate it. Everyone has unique strengths that they bring up here, but you guys just bring such amazing questions and thoughtfulness. So, thank you. Keep doing it. Don't be ashamed, or just stop asking your questions.
Councilmember Tran, it's not okay to do that. What?
Well, we'll just
respect, please. I will give that to you. I'm asking.
You disrespect me.
So if we can just close out the meeting, right? Because I will say this: if the way I look at this, Councilman Tran wants to leave early and send a message to residents that she wants to leave early.
You can censor me again and again. You know, go ahead.
Because remember, I don't particularly.
You don't
care.
Violate my right.
I don't particularly care how you
when
feel on this. If you want to leave, go ahead and leave. If you want to sit down, go ahead and sit down. But let us finish the meeting. Thank you. All right, so I too appreciate the questions, and I do want to say that this has not been a common thing, but it's a lot less common than it was 6 months ago. We can talk about that offline, but thank you for taking on this job and understanding what you were kind of walking into. Appreciate that, and appreciate you being so involved as well. Any city manager reports and announcements?
Just two things real quick. Mayor's giving the State of the City address tomorrow night at Everybody USA, some small appetizers at 5:30, presentation at 6, 3 hours. Right? I think he said.
And that, you mean just a speech?
Yeah.
That's reasonable.
Yeah, about 3.
Mm-hmm. What time does it start? Because I'll get there about 45 minutes before it's over.
Thank you for the confidence.
Come in. And then
what time is it?
And then Yeah, like 5:30 for
doors open at 5:30. I saw that.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's early.
And then on Wednesday, we're doing the employee state of the city at 9:30 if people have a chance. Both events are at Edinburgh USA. So.
I'd love to see you there. And I know employee state of the city, employees love when they see. I know it's not always easy to make it,
right?
They love it when they see city councilors there as well. They like to see us there. I like to see the employees. So, but I'd love to see you at the state of the city. So, if there's no further questions, meeting is adjourned. So, I'm going to tell you.
Are we off?
No, let me turn it.
Yeah, come on, Devin. You got that hustle. You got that muscle.
I will say in advance that, unfortunately, I will not be there tomorrow.